This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Next week marks an important anniversary in the civil rights movement. 50 years ago, on May 4, 1961, the first bus carrying an integrated group of self-proclaimed freedom riders left Washington, D.C. and headed towards the South. On today's Fresh Air, as we think about events in the South which took place 50 years ago in a different era, we also want to send our sympathies and best wishes to the thousands of people who have suffered losses from the destruction of tornadoes which tore through the South earlier this week. During the spring and summer of 1961, the Freedom Riders challenged segregation by riding together on buses through the Deep South. They demanded unrestricted access to segregated buses, as well as bus terminal restaurants and waiting rooms. The Freedom Riders were pledged to nonviolence and kept that pledge even when attacked and bloodied by their racist opponents. Our guest, Raymond Arsenault, is the author of a book called The Freedom Riders. Before we meet him, we're going to hear an excerpt of an interview Terry recorded with the late James Farmer, a co-founder of the Riders, and of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. In this 1985 interview, he described a turning point for the Freedom Riders when the group he was traveling with was arrested in Mississippi.
There were three charges: disobeying an officer, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot. We were arrested by Captain Ray, who was the chief of police of the city of Jackson, when he ordered me to move on. And I asked where. The young lady with me, who had locked arms with me, she and I were about to go into the restaurant there in the waiting room, the white waiting room, for dinner. And other Freedom Riders followed the two of us and were similarly told to get into the paddy wagon. And we were taken to jail. Then I sent orders by my lawyer to my CORE staff in New York to begin immediately recruiting Freedom Riders, white and black, from all over the country, sending them into Jackson to try, in true Gandhian fashion, to fill up the jails. We were not going to bail out. We were going to stay in as long as we could stay in and still file an appeal, and that turned out to be 40 days and 40 nights.
Did the jails want you out?
Yes. They quickly found out that we were not going to bail out right away, and then what they wanted to do was to make it so uncomfortable for us that we'd wish we had never come, and we'd stop others from coming. They did not physically beat us, though they tried once at one place, and that backfired because I got one young man bailed out, and he called the FBI, and he also held a press conference. So that stopped the physical brutality. But they did such things as putting so much salt in the food that we couldn't eat it. Many of us were chain smokers, and we were denied any cigarettes, but the guards would walk by our cells puffing on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into our cells at great length. We were students or readers. They denied us any newspapers or any books, refused to let any come in, refused to let us have any paper or any pencils to do any writing whatsoever. We were denied any visitors except our lawyer. This was psychological brutality.
You were also banned from singing at one point.
Well, they tried to stop us from singing. We sang all the freedom songs we knew, and we made up new ones. I made up one song, wrote one song. Actually, it was, I put new words to an old labor song, "Which Side Are You On?"
What were the words you wrote?
Well, these words, I can't sing, so I won't even try to sing it. Said, "Come all you freedom fighters, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Freedom Ride has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 They say in Hinds County, where Jackson was, Jackson, Mississippi, no neutrals have they met. You're either for the Freedom Ride or you're Tom for Ross Barnett." He was the governor of Mississippi. "My father was a freedom fighter, and I'm a freedom fighter's son. and I'll stick to the Freedom Ride till every battle's won. Well, the jailers went wild at our singing because we were singing as loudly as we could, and our voices were wafting out over the city of Jackson. And the windows were open. They would come in and slam our windows shut, and we would open them again and sing more and more and more. Other Freedom Riders, the black women in another wing, the white men in another wing, the white women in another wing would pick up the song, and so the jailhouse was rocking with freedom song. The jailers are running around saying, "Stop that singing! Stop that singing! Stop it!" And we continued singing because it was good for our morale. It was good for our morale, and if there were any fear left in us, that fear was dissipated by the song.
What did they do to try to prevent you from singing after closing the window and yelling at you didn't work?
Well, in Parchman, the state penitentiary, said, "If you don't stop that singing, we'll take away your mattresses." Well, now that sounds like a juvenile threat, but it was an important threat because the little thin straw mattress was the only comfort we had. Everything else was cold, hard stone and steel in those tiny little cells. But there was this little mattress, which was comfort, which was a symbol of home, symbol of domesticity. And now they're going to take that away. We'd have nothing else. Well, that caused some people to stop singing for a while until one young man who was a Bible student reminded everybody what they were doing. Said, here they're trying to take your soul away, you see. It's not the mattress, it's your soul. And then one Freedom Rider yelled, "Guards! Guards! Guards!" And the deputy came running out into the cell block to see what was wrong. And this Freedom Rider shouted, "Come get my mattress! I'll keep my soul!" And then song exploded again. We began singing. Then another time, I have to laugh when I think of this. One Freedom Rider was complaining that this deputy, who was in charge of the guards, always called us boy, you boys. He said, why does he always call us boy? We are men. I think we ought to refuse to answer until he calls us men. Another one reminded him that was just a custom down south, and he didn't mean anything derogatory by it. So this first fellow said, "I think I'll ask him." He called Deputy Tyson. Said, "Deputy Tyson, what?" Says, "Do you mean anything derogatory when you call us boy?" Deputy Tyson said, "I don't know nothing about no rogatory. All I know is if you boys don't stop that singing, you're going to be singing in the rain." And then somebody started singing again. They pulled in a high-pressure fire hose and washed us all down with it. We tumbled over and everything was floating in the water in our cells. One of the Freedom Riders then yelled, "Deputy Tyson, next time you're going to do that, bring us some soap so we can take a shower."
The late James Farmer speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1985. He died in 1999. You can hear the complete interview at our website, freshair.npr.org. Raymond Arsenault is the author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Arsenault is the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. Terry spoke with him in 2006.
Raymond Arsenault, welcome to Fresh Air. We heard James Farmer describing that the Freedom Riders didn't want to be bailed out of the Parchman prison. What was the philosophy behind that jail, no bail approach they took?
This was one of the most controversial innovations of the Congress of Racial Equality. There had been talk about jail no bail for years in the late 1950s, but no one had either marshaled enough courage or audacity to try it on any kind of mass level. And the first jail no bail actually took place in Tallahassee, Florida. A young activist named Patricia Stevens and several other activists decided to take Gandhian philosophy literally and to fill the jails as best they could. And then there was a, another jail no bail incident in Rock Hill, South Carolina in early 1961. And this gave the Corps, Congress of Racial Equality, leaders hope that this could become kind of standard operating procedure in the movement. But the Freedom Rides was really the first time that this was tried on any kind of mass level.
Why was it controversial within the civil rights movement?
It seemed to go against common sense. It seemed counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of people. Thurgood Marshall made a famous statement in Nashville when he was lecturing at Fisk, and he was criticizing the jail no bail. And he said, for God's sake, if somebody can get you out, get out. Take the offer. Anybody who knows what it's like to be in a southern jail, to be a black person or even a white person who's a dissenter in jail, knows it's a very dangerous place to be. So Marshall was taking perhaps the more pragmatic view, but jail no bail became a badge of honor and a elemental strategy for CORE during the early 1960s.
Was it a troublesome mood for the prison authorities because they had to deal with all of these civil rights activists who were being very disruptive to the prison system?
I think it was very confounding for them. They were accustomed to intimidating people. They had all kinds of ways of manipulating and threatening and in many cases actually physically harming people. And you know, southern jails, and particularly southern prisons, Parchman being the most notorious, but even the county jails and the city jails, they weren't accustomed to people trying to stay inside the bars. And so it defied logic for them, and they didn't know quite how to deal with it.
So when the Freedom Riders refused to post bail, how did they get out of prison?
Well, in the case of most of the Freedom Riders who ended up behind bars in Mississippi, more than 300 ended up in Parchman Prison, there was a quirk of Mississippi law which said you had to get out before 40 days to be able to file an appeal. And of course, ultimately, what the Congress of Racial Equality and the Freedom Riders and the other organizations involved wanted to do was to create a test case to force the legal justice system, if possible, at the local and state level, but at least at the federal level, to endorse and to sustain and protect their constitutional rights. So they needed these appeals. So they would stay in for 39 days, but they would get out on time so that they could file their appeals in the Mississippi case. And almost all the southern states had some quirks like this. Part of the game in the Freedom Rides between white segregationists and the Freedom Riders was a test of resources. They kept increasing the bond that they had to post. They tried to break the civil rights movement financially. They knew that resources were limited and that most of those resources were with the NAACP, which had an ambivalent attitude towards the Freedom Rides, that there was a feeling that the Freedom Rides was an enormous gamble. That if all this money was poured into it and there were no positive results, then this movement would be set back, that it would not advance. So there were a lot of people within the movement who had very serious questions about the wisdom of playing this very dangerous game.
The Freedom Riders were challenging segregation on interstate bus rides. Now, the buses had long been the center of protests in the South. Why were buses at the center of civil rights actions throughout the 20th century?
Well, there was an ongoing debate among civil rights activists as to where to place stress on the move for desegregation. Where should they begin? Should they begin with the schools? Should they begin with unemployment or employment policies? Should they begin with transportation? And there was no consensus on this matter. They were fighting on all fronts. But the buses and the trains and streetcars were a daily irritant for blacks. So it was a natural place where people would file lawsuits, where they would try to test the limits of Jim Crow culture. And this was particularly true in the 1940s when people began to have sort of individual freedom rides. They didn't use that term. But there were a number of people who challenged the Jim Crow conventions. Jackie Robinson, 1944, refused to move to the back of the bus near Fort Hood in Texas, and he was court-martialed. He was eventually exonerated, but that was just one example.
Now, the Freedom Riders were specifically testing new law. What law were they testing?
They were testing compliance. There had been an attempt to test compliance back in the 1940s. There was a landmark Supreme Court decision, Morgan versus Virginia, in 1946. Irene Morgan was a woman from Baltimore who was arrested for refusing to go to the back of the bus, sort of Rosa Parks style, in 1944. She represented herself at first, then the NAACP took her case, Thurgood Marshall and others took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and they won. And it seemed like segregation on interstate buses and trains had been declared illegal. But the attorneys general and other officials in the South simply ignored the decision. And they made all kinds of excuses why they couldn't enforce it. They said that the segregation was actually being maintained by company rules of railroad corporations and bus corporations, that it really wasn't state law, that it was mandating Jim Crow, all those sorts of things. This led to the first Freedom Ride. They didn't call it a Freedom Ride. It was known as the Journey of Reconciliation, where 16 volunteers who belonged to the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Congress of Racial Equality decided to do a Freedom Ride to test compliance with the Morgan decision. But they only did it in the Upper South. They knew if they went to the Deep South, to Alabama and Mississippi, it might mean major violence, maybe even certain death for them. So they spent 2 weeks in April of 1947 traveling on trains and buses in Virginia and Tennessee and Kentucky and North Carolina. Several of them were arrested. Bayard Rustin, one of the organizers, and three others ended up on a chain gang for 22 days in North Carolina. But they didn't get a lot of attention. The press carried it, but it really didn't effect a revolution. But it set a model for civil rights nonviolent direct action.
So what happened in 1961 that led to the formation of the Freedom Rides?
The election of John Kennedy gave new hope, I think, to civil rights activists. Even though he didn't have a particularly strong record as a senator, had not shown a great interest in civil rights, he talked about a new frontier. He occasionally used the rhetoric of freedom that suggested that he might be open to this, not just in foreign affairs, but in rearranging the nature of domestic life in the United States. And, of course, there were the onset of the sit-ins beginning in Greensboro, North Carolina, in February of 1960, the so-called youth movement, which is a harbinger, of course, of things to come later in the 1960s. So there was a sense that maybe nonviolent direct action on a mass scale was becoming possible, even in the Deep South.
When the Freedom Riders formed in 1961, did they have the same goal as the group in 1947 did, to try to force the government to enforce an already existent law that said that interstate bus travel could no longer be segregated?
There were two landmark Supreme Court decisions, Morgan versus Virginia in 1946, which seemed to outlaw segregation on interstate buses and, by argument, trains. But then in 1960, in December of 1960, there was a second decision, the Boynton versus Virginia decision, which appeared to outlaw segregation in public accommodations related to interstate travel, so that you could get a cup of coffee at a lunch counter, at a train station, or in a bus station if you were involved in interstate transportation. It used the Interstate Commerce Clause as the legal kind of lever to strike down state and local laws which mandated segregated facilities in restrooms, in restaurants, in lunch counters, and so forth. So there were two decisions. And it was really the Boynton decision in December of 1960, which was the immediate reason for thinking that another Freedom Ride or a set of Freedom Rides was in order.
Now, the initial group of Freedom Riders that CORE organized was basically handpicked. I mean, you almost had to audition to be part of it. Why were they so carefully selected?
CORE had a philosophy of using a vanguard of carefully trained, disciplined, nonviolent activists who would not strike back no matter what happened. They felt that this was absolutely crucial, that you needed people who understood the responsibilities of nonviolence, They were terrified that if undisciplined activists were provoked, it would turn into violence, and the cause of the movement would be set back. So they were very carefully chosen. There were several dozen applicants, and they had to be vouchsafed by ministers, by employers. If they were under 21, they had to get their parents' signature. They had to explain why they wanted to go on the Freedom Ride, and that they were willing to follow the orders of CORE. This was an extremely important part of the strategy of the original Freedom Ride.
And did that careful selection continue through the history of the Freedom Riders?
It actually didn't continue exactly the way they hoped it would. There were ultimately 436 Freedom Riders, a remarkably diverse group of people. It was intergenerational, it was interregional, it was interracial. The pace of events dictated trying to fill the buses, to fill the jails in Mississippi, to maintain the pressure, to convince Southern segregationists that the Freedom Riders were not going to go away. So there were instances where people got on the Freedom buses without being carefully screened. And there were a couple of cases where Freedom Riders turned on each other with recriminations. It was an enormously difficult thing to organize, to administer. The civil rights movement was just emerging as a national phenomenon. They never tried to do anything on this scale before. You had several organizations, CORE, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Nashville Movement, the NAACP, Fellowship of Reconciliation. Getting all these people to be on the same page and to make sure that there were no provocateurs, that there weren't FBI informers or Klan informers or people who were not working in the best interest of the Freedom Rides. It was not easy to maintain the discipline. And I think, in general, they were remarkably successful in doing so. There were relatively few incidents, but it didn't have the purity of the original ride, certainly, in the later stages.
It was the job of the Freedom Riders to remain nonviolent in spite of whatever anyone tried to do to provoke them. What were some of the violent acts directed against them that they had to endure?
Well, of course, the most famous violent acts were the bombing of a bus in Anniston, Alabama, where the Freedom Riders, the original Freedom Riders, one group of them, there was an attempt to burn them alive in the bus. They were attacked by a mob of Klansmen, actually both men, women, and children dressed in their Sunday best. It was a horrific episode, which I think really scarred many of the people who endured it, who survived it. Then, of course, the other bus that had been sent from Atlanta got to Birmingham, and there had been collusion between the Commissioner of Public Safety, Bull Connor, and the police department, and several claverns of the Ku Klux Klan. And there was a Klan mob which attacked the riders as soon as they got to the Birmingham station. There were, of course, later attacks in Montgomery. After that, the civil rights movement sort of decided they had to take a stand, that they could not allow the violence in Alabama to end the Freedom Riders in failure. And so Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders flew into Montgomery to hold a rally in First Baptist Church, Reverend Ralph Abernathy's church. The church was surrounded by a mob of several thousand white supremacists. There was a fear that they actually were going to burn the church to the ground. This was all in front of a number of reporters and television cameras. Eventually, Governor John Patterson, who was a committed segregationist but decided to mobilize the National Guard at the last minute to save the church and to save the Freedom Riders and their allies. And, of course, this is what this episode in Montgomery on May 21st, 1961, is what drew the Kennedy administration into the fray. They had to send federal marshals to try to mitigate the situation.
What did the FBI do about the Freedom Riders and about the white supremacists who were attacking them and the Southern police and sheriffs who weren't doing much to protect the Freedom Riders?
J. Edgar Hoover had no sympathy for civil rights activists. He was an avowed segregationist supporter of the status quo, and he sent that message down to the FBI, and basically the FBI in the Southern scene they often knew what was about to happen, and of course, they had advanced information about the bus burning in Anniston and the mob gathering in Birmingham, but this information was not forwarded to the rest of the Justice Department. And from that day on, Robert Kennedy was not able to trust J. Edgar Hoover.
In your book about the Freedom Riders, you described the Kennedy administration as initially seeing the Freedom Riders as a distraction from what the Kennedy administration really wanted to deal with at the time, which wasn't the civil rights movement, it was the Cold War. It was Cuba. It was the Soviet Union. So would you describe a little bit the Kennedy administration's take on the Freedom Rides and how they initially handled it?
Both the President John Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy, initially at least, and for a long time, considered the Freedom Rides to be a very disturbing distraction. The Cold War was at its height. The Freedom Rides came just after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. John Kennedy was just about to go on his first international summit meeting in Vienna. He had Khrushchev to deal with. The building of the Berlin Wall was imminent. The world seemed to be coming apart at the seams, and he did not want strife in the streets of Alabama to be on the front page. There was a strong sense among the Kennedys and many other Americans that what the Freedom Riders were doing was disloyal, that even though they may have admired their courage, they questioned their wisdom. And there were very often charges of disloyalty. Why couldn't the Freedom Riders wait for a better time? Couldn't they see that there was a deeper agenda of countering the propaganda of the Soviet Union, of making the United States look bad on the international scene? And of course, what all this had to do with was the changed situation with respect to the decolonization of the Third World. Suddenly, people of color had an important part to play in the balance of power in the world, and the civil rights leaders, particularly those involved in the Freedom Rides, sensed this, that they could use this as a lever, as a way of saying, you know, if you want to claim a legitimacy to American democracy and to spread it abroad, then you've got to live up to your own ideals at home.
So, what action did the Kennedy administration take when the Freedom Riders were being jailed and beaten?
The Kennedy administration, at first, they sent John Siegenthaler, who was a native of Nashville, Tennessee, a personal representative of both the president and the attorney general, down to try to make sure that the Freedom Riders stayed, the original Freedom Riders stayed alive. He flew with them when they gave up traveling from Birmingham to Montgomery by bus. He flew with them on the Freedom plane from Birmingham to New Orleans. And both he and the other administration officials thought that was the end of it. What they didn't realize is that there was a band of student activists, the Nashville Movement students, followers of Reverend Jim Lawson, who decided the Freedom Ride could not end this way. They could not allow the core riders to be chased out of Alabama, to flee by plane. And it was a disappointing end for the original Freedom Ride. So the student activists in Nashville and other movement centers in the South said, we can't let it end this way. So they organized another set of Freedom Rides, which was a terrible turn of events for the Kennedys. Said, oh, my God, the crisis is reheating. Now we've got all these students threatening to come into Birmingham. So that's how it restarts, and it just won't go away. By the end of May, Bobby Kennedy decides to turn to the Interstate Commerce Commission to beg them to pass a sweeping desegregation order. Now, he knew this would take weeks and even months, and in fact, he doesn't get his order until September 22nd, 1961, and it's not effective until November 1st. And of course, even though the civil rights activists, the Freedom Riders, appreciated what Kennedy was doing, they did not adhere to his call for a cooling off period. They said, we've been cooling off for a century. We're not going to cool off anymore. We want freedom now. We want you to prove to us that the ICC will render a sweeping desegregation order. So that's why the Freedom Riders continue to board the buses and to continue to have these freedom rides throughout the summer. And more people get involved as they come mostly into Jackson, Mississippi, and ultimately to Parchman Prison.
And one of the things you write about in your book about the Freedom Riders is how the media covered the riders and what the impact the media coverage had. And something I found really surprising in your discussion of the media is what you write about David Brinkley. You write, David Brinkley editorialized that the Freedom Riders are, quote, accomplishing nothing whatsoever and, on the contrary, are doing positive harm. The result of these expeditions are not of benefit to anyone, white or Negro, the North or the South, nor the U.S. in general. We think they should stop it. Where did he say this?
David Brinkley did a commentary on the NBC Nightly News. He, of course, was from North Carolina. I think considered himself to be a moderate liberal, certainly someone who didn't normally endorse Jim Crow segregation, but he felt that the Freedom Riders were being unreasonable. And he was not alone in this. There were a number of sort of mainstream journalists who were supported by the public opinion polls. In general, more than two-thirds of Americans, although they supported the ideal of desegregation in most cases, rejected the tactics of the Freedom Riders. And Brinkley was speaking for them, suggesting that there was something unpatriotic about what the Freedom Riders were doing by not recognizing the damage that they were doing to America's reputation, to its image around the world. And he felt that they simply were naive, that they were provocateurs, that they were largely young kids who didn't know what they were doing. Furious at them, as many Americans were, because they would not allow the United States to go back to business as usual until the problems that they were addressing were paid attention to.
You found a lot of former Freedom Riders for your book, you know, as part of your research. Is there anything, any kind of observation that nearly every Freedom Rider you spoke to shared? Is it something that they all had in common about the way they saw the Freedom Rides?
You know, I've often said that the Freedom Rides showed that ordinary people could do extraordinary things, but after working 10 years on this book, I really don't believe that these are or were ordinary people. There were 436 of them. They took amazing risks, displayed extraordinary courage in the face of widespread censure. I mean, their own families, in many cases, telling them that they were doing things that were making them ashamed, that they were making the mistake of their lives, that they were being unreasonable, that they were going down a road that would hurt themselves and hurt the nation, and how they stayed the course, how they kept their eyes on the prize, is sometimes beyond me. Oftentimes historians, when they dig deeper into a topic, when they see the real historical figures, it can be kind of disillusioning. That's not what happened here. The deeper I probed, the more respect I had for them, and I'm in awe, really, not only of what they did in 1961, but what many of them have continued to do. They really dedicated their lives to social justice, and It's just an incredibly empowering message, it seems to me.
Among the people who you interviewed who had been Freedom Riders, did any of them have scars, and I don't mean emotional scars, I mean physical scars, or disabilities from beatings that they had taken during the Freedom Rides? And if so, how do they regard those scars or disabilities now?
There were a number of Freedom Riders who emerged with physical scars. Most of them are dead now. Walter Bergman, who was a white Freedom Rider from Michigan who was nearly beaten to death in the original Freedom Ride, eventually filed a lawsuit where he won a kind of a nominal judgment against the FBI for its complicity for an FBI informer in the beating. He lived to be 99 despite he was in a wheelchair most of the rest of the years of his life. William Barbie, one of the most poignant of the riders, who was the advance scout into Montgomery. He was attacked at the bus station in Montgomery, and they stuck a jagged piece of metal into his temple, He never recovered, and he lived 20 more years, but was never the same. Ed Blankenheim, a writer that I interviewed at great length, a white writer who died last year in San Francisco, had been a carpenter and a part-time student at the University of Arizona. The joke among the freedom writers, even though he was a secular writer, was that, as Hank Thomas, one of the other writers, said, Jesus sent us a carpenter from Arizona. Ed suffered a stroke later in his life and was in part a result of some of the things that he experienced in the rides. But they wear them as badges of honor. I can't tell you how many times the freedom writers have told me, often with tears in their eyes, that this was the moment of their lives. At the time, even though they were being told they were making a mistake, they now know that this was whatever else they did in their lives, whatever injuries they suffered, that their lives made a difference. They didn't get everything they wanted. Some of the ideals have not been realized, but they stood up for justice at a critical moment in American history when relatively few people were willing to do so. And so whatever injuries they suffered, and they certainly did suffer them, they wore them, I think, and continue to wear them as a badge of honor.
Raymond Arsenault, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Raymond Arsenault speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. He's the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida and author of the book Freedom Riders. Roy Orbison was in many ways the man he sang about in his songs, alone. Certainly he didn't imitate anyone or ride any trends. Although he started out as a rockabilly performer on Sun Records, he didn't really find his identity until he signed with the small Nashville label Monument in 1959. There he cut 17 singles that put him and Monument on the map. Here's rock historian Ed Ward.
Fred Foster signed Roy Orbison in 1959. His label Monument had already had a smash hit with Billy Grammer's Gotta Travel On. At first, it seemed he wasn't sure what to do with Orbison and tried a rock and roll novelty with The Bug, which flopped, not least because the backup band, the cream of Nashville sidemen, including Hank Sugarfoot Garland on guitar, Floyd Kramer on piano, and Buddy Harmon on drums, sound so uncomfortable. Nashville, though, was changing, and rock and roll wasn't part of the plan. Pop music was.
The finest thing that you ever seen.
Orbison had written his own material so far, and in Nashville he took on partners, including Joe Melson, a friend from Texas. Uptown was their first collaboration, but it was their next one which established Roy's career.
Dum, dum, dum.
Joining the Anita Kerr Singers for the Dum 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 Doobie Doo Wah, Orbison began to explore what his voice could do. It wasn't very powerful yet, and for the recording, he stood behind an improvised isolation booth made from the musicians' coats. The stark, miserable lyric hit home with teenagers and shot to number 2 on the pop charts. An album, Lonely and Blue, was quickly recorded, and legend has it that when Fred Foster saw the cover, showing Orbison leaning his head on his arms while seated in the front seat of a car, he was shocked at how close together the singer's eyes were. "Get some dark glasses on him," he said. An image was born, although Orbison claimed it was due to a mistake in choosing glasses to wear on stage one night. It was a time of extreme teen pop, with songs of death and alienation cloaked in strings and backup vocals. Roy Orbison led the way.
Just run and escape. Each place we go, so afraid that he might show. Yeah, run and
Running Scared was one of the most radical pop records yet. Orbison's voice changed register over the bolero rhythm, but there was no chorus, and all the release comes at the end. It was his first number one record, and, as if to tempt fate, he followed this with another extreme performance.
I was all right for a while. I could smile.
Crying winds up in the stratosphere with Orbison's falsetto getting a workout. It was something he was beginning to use a lot, as on this odd bit of exotica. Was a hit, and since he was also popular in England, he was offered a tour there in 1963 after headliner Duane Eddy dropped out. By the time he got there, the opening band, the Beatles, were ending the shows. "What's a Beatle, anyway?" was Orbison's reaction. John Lennon, who overheard him, tapped him on the shoulder and said, "I am." But he soon found out that Please Please Me, their current hit, was partially intended as an homage to him. And unlike what happened to many pop performers, the Beatles didn't threaten Orbison's hold on the charts. In the height of Beatlemania and the British invasion, he had time for one more number one record, one of his greatest performances. Astonishingly, not long after this triumph, Orbison left Monument for MGM Records, where his career would eventually wither, albeit not forever. When he died in 1988, he had two albums sitting atop the charts.
Ed Ward reviewed Roy Orbison, the Monument Singles Collection on Legacy Recordings. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.